If you think you can't go from politics to the divine, Carol Gold and Steve Clark are about to take you above the fray. The only agenda here is to empower you to think for yourself, ask more questions, and trust your own truth. So now, the combination talk radio has been missing. Until now, Carol Gold and Steve Clark taking you above the fray.
Hi, I'm Carol Gold, and this is what I guess we could consider a special edition of Above the Fray podcast. I'm here. My co-host will be joining me shortly, Steve Clark. In the meantime, if you're listening live, the number, call in, 914-803-4522. Your opinions and your thoughts and your contribution to the show are always welcome. The reason that Steve and I decided to do this additional episode this week is because we got into a conversation yesterday while we were on air, and the conversation actually was supposed to be a brief prelude to what the rest of the show was about, and that preliminary conversation wound up taking up most of the show. And when it ended, Steve and I talked off air and decided that the issues that pertain to the show that we wound up doing were so important that while we will continue on our next episode what we had scheduled for yesterday, we nonetheless in this episode wanted to follow through and go deeper into the discussion that wound up taking up most of yesterday's show. So having explained all that, and whether you followed it or not, it doesn't really matter, because what I'm going to get to now is the meat of this show. There was in Irving, Texas this week an incident where a young Muslim boy, his name is, I think it was Ahmed Muhammad, brought to school, a teenager, a bright, very bright young man. He brought to school what appeared on its face to be a suitcase bomb. However, what it was in reality was a Radio Shack clock that he disassembled, took out of its casing, put into the suitcase, and created a countdown. And when the countdown ended, an alarm went off. It was made, according to security experts and bomb experts, it was made exactly the way you would make a suitcase bomb and looked exactly what a suitcase bomb would look like. The story, at least one side of it, that has become public is that he was there was an overreaction to him. The police acted, as the president likes to say, stupidly, prematurely. They took him in, they booked him, they fingerprinted him. And this all became an incident of Islamophobia. And in fact, the president of the United States invited him to the White House next month. The president tweeted at the time, "Ahmed, nice, cool clock. How'd you like to show it off here in the White House?" That's paraphrasing, but he did say, "Ahmed, cool clock," and invited him to the White House. And in fact, just yesterday, Ahmed was a special guest at Google for their science fair. Now, there are a couple of things that are true here, and then there are a whole bunch of facts that I want to share with you on this show that have not been made public, at least not in mainstream media. So what is true is that Ahmed is a very bright young man. What is also true is that he came to school with this, quote, invention, as he calls it. It's not an invention. An invention is something that never existed before. It was literally a Radio Shack clock put into a metal box, carried like a suitcase, and wired or rigged to count down and set off an alarm. There's hardly anything rocket science about that. And it's also true, as Ahmed has said in his own words, that he knew it could cause potential upset. He knew that it might create a problem. So he brought this to school. He showed it to his first teacher. And his first teacher said, "Okay, not sure why you did it. There wasn't a project. There wasn't a science fair. There wasn't any reason for him to do it or bring it to school. But okay, interesting. Put it in your locker and don't take it around school because it could cause a problem. He ignored the teacher's instructions, and he took it to his next class, which I believe was an English class with a female teacher. It counted down. The alarm went off. She got upset, scared, called the principal. The principal brought Ahmed to his office. Ahmed was very uncooperative in answering questions, so the police were called, and it went on from there. The police questioned him. He was not cooperative. And I know this because I've listened to an interview of the mayor of Irving, Texas, the part of the story that is not being made public. And here's why. Ahmed is a minor, and therefore the records that pertain to the detention and the questioning and the fingerprinting, etc., and his response or non-responsiveness, his non-cooperation, cannot be released without the consent of the family. And the family won't consent to the release of the record. Now, there's more about the family that's very critical and very important to know and is not, again, part of the national mainstream story. Ahmed's father is from the Sudan. He has run for president of the Sudan twice in his life. They live here part of the year, and part of the year they go back to the Sudan, or at least his father and mother do. And so his father is also active in the Muslim community in Irving, Texas. Now, the backstory that you need to know in Irving, Texas is there was not too long ago a confrontation there, meaning there's a large Muslim population outside of Dallas. They have a huge mosque. I believe it's the largest Muslim population in the United States. And they wanted to implement a Sharia court that would operate independently of the municipal court in Irving. And the mayor opposed it. The board had a contentious vote, and by a majority of one, the board voted to not allow the Sharia court. Understand, the Sharia court was to take the place of the municipal court, the United States court, within that county, within that municipality. It was to take the place of it, not just for religious law, but all of Sharia law. And if you know anything, then you know that Sharia law is, in fact, inconsistent with, incompatible with, and cannot exist side by side with the law in, let's say, a constitutional republic like the United States. So it was voted down. This mosque is very active in spreading, in creating a Sharia-type government, and in spreading Islam here in the United States. And Ahmed's father is a member of that mosque. So here we have a son of an obviously Muslim activist father who brings an unsolicited, unassigned, what looks like a bomb to class. He's told to put it in his locker and doesn't. It counts down, an alarm goes off, the teacher gets frightened. Now, for a moment, and I see that Steve has joined us, and let me just welcome him to the show. Hi, Steve, welcome to the show.
Hi, Carol.
So, Steve, just say something again so I make sure it sounds working on you.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. Test.
Yep, we got you. Okay, great, Steve. So I'm filling people in on the backstory, Steve, of what's happened up till now in Irving, Texas.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So where did I just leave off, Steve?
Just that it was the largest mosque in Texas.
Oh.
That it was. There was a countdown in the clock in the classroom, and the teacher got nervous.
So for a moment, thank you, Steve. For a moment, let's make believe he's not Muslim. Let's make believe he's just an ordinary American kid. He's Jewish, he's Christian, whatever he is, he's not a Muslim. And he comes to school with what appears to be a bomb. What would you expect any school to do, given the environment we live in the United States, given the Boston bombing, given the Twin Towers, given the spread of violence, given homegrown terrorists, given terrorists that have come across the unprotected southern border, what would you expect any school to do? In fact, I would argue that any school that didn't do what that school did would be liable for any harm that came as a result. And even if harm didn't come, I would propose that any school would be liable for gross negligence in not questioning, detaining, and getting the backstory on why a student came to school with what appeared to be a bomb in a suitcase. However, this story gets more troubling because after the incident, Ahmed's family, the municipality, the school district, the police, and the mayor reached out to the family and wanted to meet with them to find out what had gone on. Well, the family refused to meet initially. Then they agreed to schedule a meeting on Monday, and they canceled it at the last minute. They rescheduled for Wednesday, I believe it was. I may have my days mixed up, but the facts are correct in terms of the scheduling. They rescheduled for a subsequent day. They canceled that and then scheduled it for a later time on the same day and were a no-show. They never showed up for that last scheduled meeting. But at the exact time that they were to appear with and meet with the school district and the mayor, they were on their front lawn accompanied by CAIR, CAIR, the Council for American Islamic Relations, a front group for the Muslim Brotherhood. They were on their front lawn with CAIR and MSNBC giving a press conference about the innocence of their son. The whole story feels wrong, mainly because you've only got a fraction of it. You've got one side of it through the mainstream media. In addition, I watched an interview with the mayor of Irving, and she said something very troubling in that interview. She said that when the president tweeted, "Cool clock, Ahmed, want to come show it in the White House," the story had not yet been released as to what he brought to school, that it was in fact a clock. How did the president release that? So I have two questions about that. I don't want to be too conspiratorial, and I don't want to say that, you know, the president knew in advance. What I want to say are two things. One, isn't this another instance of the president acting prematurely? In the Boston case, the Boston police acted stupidly. It was Michael Brown, the gentle giant. And with Trayvon Martin, it could have been his son. This guy's always jumping in without facts. For a constitutional lawyer, I find that reprehensible. He doesn't care about the facts. He cares about what side he wants to come down on. But also, it seems to me that someone got to the White House very quickly with the story of what had gone down in Irving, Texas, and it wasn't anyone in the school district or the mayor's office or the police, because to this day, neither of them, none of the three of those entities, the mayor, the police department, nor the school board, has heard from the White House or anyone representing the federal government. So someone notified the president, and I can only assume it came from Ahmed's side. So now, the reason that I've given you all the that is the background. The reason that I wanted to do the show, the reason Steve and I wanted to do the show, is because after the show was over yesterday and Steve and I started to talk, I shared with him something that I thought is pretty much common knowledge, but maybe it's not. So let me share it with you. Because I think this looks like a setup or a test run, whether it's a test run for actually someone bringing a bomb to school or whether it's a setup to make Irving look Islamophobic, whatever it is, it looks like a setup to me. And I said to Steve that what I think is happening to us has happened before in history. Most recently, it happened in Germany in the 1930s. And it's this. You can slowly be manipulated into silence. And it happens in stages. It doesn't happen overnight. It happens by making people afraid to speak up for what they know is right and true, because it looks like you're the troublemaker. It's almost as if the reality is reversed. And what happened in Nazi Germany, I believe, is happening here in the United States now, whether it's coming exclusively from Islamic extremism or whether it's coming from a combination of communism and Islamic extremism or some variation of that theme or of those players, those actors. I believe that's what's happening, that we are being subverted from within. It's not going to take a physical war to take us down. And what I would say is this. Whether or not you know it, Iran used to be called Persia. It was called Persia until the Grand Mufti of Baghdad, of Iran, of Tehran, went to visit Adolf Hitler. And the Grand Mufti was so on board with annihilating the Jews and the Hitler world domination goal that when they went, when he went back and his delegation went back to Persia, they renamed it Iran. Iran in Farsi means Aryan. You know, as in the Aryan nation, as in Germany, as in only Aryans are pure. Islam, in terms of Iran, is totally on board with the Nazi plan to annihilate the Jews and have a world government. The only difference is that Hitler had his own vision of the government, and obviously Islam, it's Sharia and the caliphate. So this is what happened in Germany early on. It was a slow turning against the Jews, the homosexuals, the physically and the mentally infirm. It was a slow marginalizing of certain segments of society where people became afraid to speak against certain voices. I think it's happening here now. And I think what just happened in Irving is a perfect example. And it worries me a great deal. It worries me a great deal for a couple of reasons. Personally, I live in Texas. My southern border isn't secure, and I've got the largest Muslim population in the country living 3 hours north of me, and a mosque that just tried to institute Sharia law, and now a Muslim young teenager who brings what looks like a bomb to school for no apparent reason. And that's hardly an invention, even though it's being termed one. Secondly, I'm concerned because the media isn't doing its job, which isn't new, but in this case is deadly because they are making it by their passivity and their failure to cover the whole story, they are giving power, they are aiding and abetting the movement to make anything said about Islam or anyone who is a Muslim be a reactionary, extreme, oppressive, biased, bigoted, Islamophobic opinion, observation, or action. And while there are, I am certain, Muslims who do not deserve any of those, I am certain as well there are Muslims who do. And if we are afraid to make that distinction, if we are afraid to call something that on its face is suspect, and in any other situation would have been handled exactly as it had been. If we're afraid to do that because someone is Muslim, then we're beginning to be silenced. And that is a dangerous place for us to go. Steve, I gave a lot of background, and I shared just now some of my opinions about what my concerns are, and we can talk a lot more about this, but I want to turn it over to you now and hear what you have to say about any of that.
Yeah, I think you raise a valid point. And actually, I'll turn it to the humor side. There was a recent episode in South Park, which has gotten a lot of traction on the show. And basically what it was a show about the stifling of free speech. And the analysis of it, which I found fascinating, is that in our culture today, what is happening is we're assigning a sense of nobility to victimhood, a sense of sainthood, of better qualities, a measure of godliness and goodness to people who are oppressed. And if you look at the cases like with Bruce Jenner or Caitlyn Jenner, however you want to call it, the transgender movement, all these groups that are quote unquote oppressed tend to have a much bigger role in society and a much bigger voice. And I would argue it's the same with the Muslims. By the sheer fact that there's a narrative in the media that they are oppressed here in the United States, they've been able to take advantage of a situation like this. So just by the sheer fact that a Muslim boy took a clock, an innocent-looking clock, into school because of his stature in society, that he comes from a quote-unquote oppressed minority, his actions are seen as more saintly. The overreaction to such is seen as more ghastly by the people who do it. So I personally think that it was actually they did a brilliant marketing ploy. They knew what the narrative of the media was, and they knew the narrative of how it would play. Let's be clear, the media is based in really large urban centers. For the most part, they come from wealthy backgrounds. And so in many ways, the media has become more disassociated with mainstream America than ever for a story like this. So if a story like this catches national news, it's going to be reported out of New York, out of Washington, out of the major news centers. And they're not going to understand the context of somewhere, living next to one of the largest mosques in Texas, walking the grounds in, for example, a place like New York, New Jersey, or some of these lower income areas where there is a high influence of Muslims in those communities. So they're a bit disassociated with what's really happening in the country. The same way that I would argue what's happening south of the border. People who have never been to McAllen or Brownsville or those border towns, or people in those border towns, have no idea what the impact is happening on mass immigration. So getting back to your point, so staying on point with this, is that I agree with you. It was done as a marketing ploy to silence the majority, so to speak. They're silencing the people who would not be happy with somebody bringing an Obama to school. I mean, let's be. I know you talked about a few different instances, but let's be clear. There's been some numerous instances over just the last couple of years. The shooting in Connecticut, the shooting in Colorado. There's been numerous incidents at kids' schools regarding shootings. So schools are extremely sensitive to this. If there had been any other person, any other demographic, it would have been a non-story. Because they know the situation, what's happening in the country right now. But the sheer fact that it was a Muslim, it enabled them to get that story out there. So I think you're spot on with your analysis, Carol.
Well, there's more, Steve. You say if it was any other situation. There have been kids who have been suspended for using their index finger and their thumb to hold up a gun, to make believe they're shooting. There have been children who have been, there was a kid who was suspended for, I think it was like a Pop-Tart. He chewed around it until he made the shape of a gun. There have been many children in the last year either disciplined by schools or suspended for all of these sort of innocuous references to weaponry. And yet, this kid brings in an actual ticking, hello, it was ticking down. And I listened to a bomb expert who's he's president of one of the largest private security companies in the world, and he used to defuse bombs when he was in the military. And he said, that's exactly how you build a suitcase bomb, what that kid did. That's exactly how you build it, and that's exactly what it would look like. So it boggles the mind. I can't believe that this brilliant, which is how they talk about him, kid who didn't have an assignment, out of the blue, decides to build this thing that he has to know the environment of schools. he has to know how Muslims are perceived in America. His father is a former candidate for president of the Sudan twice, and active in an activist mosque in the city in which they live. The kid had to know what he was doing, or the kid was used. The kid was manipulated, one or the other. But to believe that the kid just brought this in for his own brilliance, there's nothing brilliant about dissembling a Radio Shack clock and putting it into a Walmart metal container, which is what he did. So for me, it's really troublesome, because all of these other kids that have been suspended or disciplined who have not been Muslim didn't get front page, didn't get invited to the White House, didn't have all sorts of horrible things written about the school board or the principal or the teachers or the police in cases if the police were involved. None of those other stories got traction. I believe this story was set up for traction. It was set up deliberately. Again, I don't know the motive. I don't know whether it was a dry run for a school bomb here or elsewhere. I don't know. I don't know whether or not it was a poke the beast setup. Let's see how much we can prod the establishment and get what we want out of it so that we can advance our agenda. I don't know whether it was a setup because they want to continue to build on this false narrative of Islamophobia, especially, by the way, in a state that they are desperately trying to turn blue, okay? Desperately trying to turn Texas blue. I don't know, but the whole thing is clearly some kind of a setup. It was something that was done deliberately and with forethought of knowledge, even if it was just Ahmed who knew he was bringing something in that was going to create a problem. He said that on video after the fact. So, you know, whether he got that from his parents, whether he's been raised and somewhat radicalized and he wanted to poke the beast himself, I'm not sure. But somewhere this story doesn't pass the smell test to me. And I find it deeply troubling because, you know, The more we cower, the more we stay silent, the more we want to go about our lives and not be involved because it's just more trouble than it's worth, the more like sheep we become. And maybe this is actually a perfect, I don't necessarily want to segue, but let me say here, Steve, that one of the stories we didn't get to talk about in depth on the show yesterday was the military telling American soldiers, U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, who are witnessing the sexual abuse of children, of young boys, by officers and higher-ups in the Afghani army that we're training. So they're working with us. They're working with us, and we're there training them. And they are routinely and daily and every night sexually abusing little boys because it's the thing to do. It's their, quote, culture. And our soldiers are being told not to intervene. Now, let me say this. Those same soldiers that are being told not to intervene were raised in a country where sexual abuse of children would be reported in an instant if they saw it. They were raised in a culture where that's an abomination, where that is a perversion, where that is a criminal act subject to incarceration. If you then take these young boys, young men, and you send them over there and you not only ask them to fight a war and get maimed and potentially die and risk their lives every day, but you also say to them, and by the way, everything you learned about protecting children is a lie, or at least it's something that you can turn a blind eye to now because we're in war, and we want to get along with these people, so let them abuse their children. You wonder why we have soldiers coming back with a suicide rate that's off the chart. What do you think you can do to a human mind before you twist it past the point of sanity? I find it so appalling. And so the reason I link them, Steve, and I know you have thoughts on this because you're an inactive, you know, a former Marine who is now inactive. Is that the right language? I never know the right way to say it. Steve? Hello? We lost them. Okay. Well, maybe he'll call back in.
It's a former Marine. I apologize. I was on mute. Former Marine is the proper lingo.
Okay. So he's a former Marine. I know Steve has thoughts on this, but why I brought the two together is they both have to do with values, and they both have to do with who we want to be as Americans. If we are afraid to speak up, if we want to capitulate to Islam because it's the religion du jour among leftists in this country now, and it's the cause célèbre of Hollywood to be inclusive of Muslims, if we allow ourselves to be silenced and not questioned, by the way, a religion that allows no questioning, we know this, the only religion in the world that you're not allowed to question one word of the Quran. I will tell you, as a Jew, the Torah is also considered to be holy, divinely given, and you're not allowed to change one word of the Torah, the first five books of Moses. However, you are responsible to question it. You're not allowed to change any of it, but it is demanded of you as a Jew to constantly question why is it this way in the Torah? Why does God say this? Unlike Islam, where you're not allowed to question anything about it. You just have to blindly follow it. If we're going to allow ourselves to be silenced, to be cowardly, to cower, to literally cower in the face of what appears to be legitimate questioning, and at the same time we are over in Afghanistan allowing little boys to be raped and sexually abused and dressed as little girls so that these sick adult men can make believe they're having sex with a female who's 8 years old instead of a boy who's 8 years old, all of it reprehensible, then nobody's going to have to beat us in a war. Nobody's going to have to come shoot us. They will take us from within, as the communists always said they would do. We will collapse from within because we are nothing but our culture. We are nothing but our values. We are nothing but the principles by which we not only espouse, but by which we live. And I am deeply concerned for the United States of America and for the silence and the fear that is being spread around Islam here in this country. Steve?
Yeah, Carol, yeah. You bring up a really fascinating point is in the nature of war. Is that is you know, I guess the best parallel for a long-term war was, I would say, in Vietnam. And we ran into the same issues. We ran into large cultural issues that it wasn't Judeo-Christian. It was, you know, it was more of a, it was more based on Confucianism, just based, you know, it was just a different culture. So the things that we brought to a democracy and the way that we rule are very different in different cultures. And I think, you know, a lot of people have given this a lot of thought, and you go and you hit the nail on the head. You bring to the point is that what's the point of going to war to establish a functioning government, so to speak, a democracy, and these are real issues. And the fact of the matter is that they don't function as democracies. They have a different, completely different cultural outlook and view. And you know, all you have to do is really, you know, pick up any spend any time in, I don't know, in the Middle East, anytime you can go to the bookstore and there's numerous books on how the Middle East functions and the mentality and the culture. It's very, very different to Western culture. So to the extent that we're sacrificing lives and sacrificing people and sacrificing money and all these things that we're sacrificing, you know, sticking our head in a hornet's nest for a vision that we have of the Middle East that the people, they themselves don't share, you know, it's the height of arrogance and it's the height of naivety that we've engaged in. And you know, back to your point is that, you know, having friends that are still in the Middle East, they'll tell you that, you know, this type of sexual abuse on young kids is rampant. It's not outside the norm. So if that's something that's in the context of the norm in Afghanistan, you know, how does that put our troops at risk? How does it, you know, it's a complete antithesis of Western cultural values, where children are respected and to be honored and to be taken care of as seen as people of the most innocent and the most vulnerable of our society. So it's at complete odds of a functioning society. And I think that's been our gravest mistake, is not understanding that the culture that we're fighting and the culture that we plan to implement our values in. And so that's, you know, that's why I've become really, against his work. It's, you know, if after we leave, there has been no progress. I mean, I know, just take a look at how Iraq and Libya were run, you know, prior to us getting there. They were, you know, with Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi, they were strong, tough guys, but they kept a semblance of peace and a semblance of normalcy into society, barbaric as it may seem. But, you know, if you listen to a lot of comments after the war, a lot of the people will say that society's gotten much more violent and much more dangerous after those two individuals left. So, you know, there is something to be said for that we on our side, where we sit from a Western standpoint, we say, oh, those guys are evil, those guys are terrible. But many people within, you know, I would say the common man that lived in Iraq or Afghanistan have commented, now I'm not saying this is universal, but many have commented that society was safer and more stable with those two ruthless dictators. So there's my point in driving this home is that there seems to be a complete lack of understanding of how these societies work, which makes our mistakes even graver than they normally would be.
Your comment about Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi is right on point. The reason there was some level of stability, I'm not saying that either one of them weren't bad actors, but the reason there was stability under them, a semblance of stability, stability Arab style, the reason there was stability was because in the Arab world, first of all, it's tribal. It's still tribal. To this day, it's tribal. It's why you have Sunni fighting Shia when they're both Muslim. They're both Muslims. It's why even within Sunni and Shia, you have one tribe that fights the other, because the Arab world has evolved but never jettisoned the tribal mentality. And what the tribal mentality honors is force, pure might. That's what is seen as admirable in the Arab world. And so when you get a Saddam Hussein or you get a Gaddafi or you get an Assad, the reason those countries are manageable is because what you have is basically the toughest chieftain in charge. And that's the only thing Arabs understand is force. And in fact, in the Arab world, negotiation is seen as a weakness. It's seen as a weakness, which always fascinates me that the world doesn't listen to Benjamin Netanyahu. The Israelis have lived in an Arab world all of their existence, both biblically and the modern state of Israel since 1948. They know better than anyone else outside of the Arab world. They know the Arab mind. They know the Arab culture. They not only live within an Arab part of the world, surrounded, they live with Arabs within Israel, both hostile and friendly, both Israeli Arabs and Palestinians and terrorists in Gaza and in the Sinai. They understand the Arab mindset. And also because, if you go back far enough, Jews were also tribal. And so there is a real historical understanding. So when a Benjamin Netanyahu has spent his entire life, just about since he was a young man, in politics, either in the military or in the political realm, tries to come to the West and say, look, here's what's going on. Here's the picture. Here's the solution. he isn't just talking about saving Israel, although I would be lying if I said that wasn't his main thrust. He's really talking about saving the Western world because we don't understand what the Arab world respects and how it functions. And so when we sat down with Iran to negotiate this new deal, if you notice, people say, how could we not get our hostages out? We have four hostages there. How did we cut this deal and not get hostages? How did we cut this deal and give them a 24-day waiting period before inspections after they get a notice of 6 days that they're even going to be inspected? How did we allow them in a side agreement to be their own inspectors at two of the most dangerous and deadly reactor sites? Well, it happened because when they sat down with us, they perceived us as weak. It's because we have, because this administration has shown that it draws red lines in the sand and then it ignores them. So they know that this administration has no backbone. And for the Arab world, that's like a kid in a candy store. They can't get at it fast enough. So of course they sat down at a negotiating table with a pompous, American who thinks he's from France, John Kerry, and the Obama administration representatives, because they knew they already had them by the you-know-whats. They already had them, and they expected to get what they wanted out of the deal, and it's why it's such a bad deal. And it's why Netanyahu continues to say, among others, it's no longer Netanyahu. It's also people in our military, in our Pentagon. There are people, other countries, it's a bad deal, okay? But it's a bad deal because of a lack of understanding of what you said, Steve, which is it is such a cultural difference that there's no bridge. There's no bridge to get from one to the other. And it's why it makes me so angry when I read about the suicide rate among veterans, because you really send young men over there and you ask them to be schizophrenic. You ask them to leave behind the values they were taught. It's bad enough when you, and I'm going to say this and I've never been to war, it's bad enough when you send someone who's raised in a culture that reveres life and raised with Christian and Judeo values, and you send them off to war, and you ask of them to do things that are abhorrent to the human heart. You ask them to kill people. It's bad enough to do that to young minds. But to also send them into environments and ask them to witness, turn a blind eye, and thereby condone behavior that is actionable, punishable within their own culture, it's no wonder these guys come home and they can't get their heads straight. It's no wonder they come home and they can't stop the nightmares. It's no wonder they come home and they feel like they can't even live within their own skin. We're doing that to them. And so as a result of reading that article, Steve, about the suicide rate within that particular battalion, I came to a conclusion I've never had before in my life. And I've heard it said, but I never really got it until I read this article and I read about the suppression of witnessing young boys being sexually abused and our military telling our guys to stand down. War is meant to be won. You go to war, you go in to win. Otherwise, don't go. And so what we've done in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere in the Middle East and what we're now pussyfooting around with in Syria is not war. It's some political game. I didn't realize we're almost out of time. You go to win. You go to win or you don't go. You go, you turn it into a parking lot, and you come home. And yes, there's collateral damage, but better collateral damage once and swiftly and then out of there than this war of attrition, where we're not only losing the war physically, we're being usurped from within at the same time, and I'm not sure which one gets us first. Steve, less than a minute if you want.
Yeah, two things real quickly. The first thing is in terms of concessions and negotiations, in the Arab mind, concessions are seen as a weakness. So right. If you looked at what happened in Israel in the peace accords, when they signed those deals with Yasser Arafat, it wasn't a signal for progress, as the West believed. The Arab minds saw it as a sign of weakness, and hence it was a signal to attack more. attacks happened in greater frequency after the cordial sign, not less, because it was seen as a sign of weakness to the Arabs. So I think that's a big
30 seconds.
It's a big point for people to understand that the minds of the two countries are completely different. So I know we're out of time. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Please like us on Facebook at AboveTheFrayPodcast.com, and please like us on iTunes. It really helps us get us more ratings. Carol?
Have a great day, everybody. I'm Carol Gold. This has been Above the Fray Podcast.
You've been listening to Above the Fray with Carol Gold and Steve Clark, from politics to the divine. Thanks for being a part of a new way to see the world. Visit our website at AboveTheFrayPodcast.com and like us on our Facebook fan page, Facebook.com/AboveTheFrayPodcast. This has been Carol Gold and Steve Clark, taking you always above the fray.